Good morning.
Good morning.
One of those admonitions we often heard as children was don't talk to strangers. Many of us were groomed, in fact, to be wary and distrustful, fearful. Still, according to Lord Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi in the UK, the Hebrew Bible commands us only once to love thy neighbor, commands us 36 times to love the stranger. Hospitality to strangers is a core principle in most of the world's great religious traditions, and yet we only have to look at our own national dialogue about immigration, or closer to home, I'm embarrassed to say it, my own behavior behind the wheel making my daily crosstown commute, to see that we've largely tossed that one aside. While we're used to hearing the expressions a complete stranger, a total stranger, I'm struck by the equally common expression perfect stranger and by its unintended double meaning. Dozens of times in my life, I've encountered the perfect stranger, just the right person at the right moment who offers the right kindness, the right smile, says the right word, poses the right question, or maybe points me in a direction I never would have considered. To put that last piece in a more personal, broader context, I need to share that I have judged myself rather harshly throughout my life for not having taken a more conventional, linear path to professional success. You know what I mean, college, graduate school, good job, better job, make more money, then you retire, then you die. And at the same time, I've taken no small satisfaction having chosen a more circuitous path. But I can blame a few perfect strangers for that, who have stood right in the middle of my path uninvited. One such person is a member of my home congregation in Santa Monica, Cassandra Christensen, who over 25 years ago stood in the middle of my path and held up a sign that pointed to chaplaincy. It would take many years for me to get there. Sometimes if we keep our hearts and eyes open, a stranger can be there to point us in that direction we wouldn't have considered. Another example came for me in 1973. I was a freshman at UCLA, majoring in design, very focused on my future, my career, my success. I also happened to really love dancing, and I was taking dance classes at the old Roland Dupre studio on La Cienega. I was even on scholarship, which meant I could take as many classes as I wanted for free in exchange for a few chores around the studio. That's because Roland thought he was grooming a future professional. I knew in my bones that that wasn't in the cards for me, but I went along with the program because I wanted the classes. I was part of a small company of dancers that gave a one-night concert performance to showcase the choreography of one of the teachers at the studio, Chuck Moore. Another of the teachers at the studio, Joe Bennett, came to see that performance and was apparently very impressed with my work, so much so that he invited a friend of his, Walter Painter, well-known choreographer at the time, to come observe me in class because he knew Walter needed another male dancer to fill out his chorus for a season of summer stock at the Sacramento Music Circus. Well, the whole class apparently knew who Walter was except me. They were all knocking themselves out and selling it to beat the band, and there I was, clueless. But I was the one who got the note after class. Michael, please call me about work. So I called him, and he offered me the job. And my initial response, I'm a little embarrassed to say, was, Sacramento? In the summer? It's kind of hot, isn't it? I was 18 years old. What was I thinking? What better summer job could there be? And it certainly paid a hell of a lot more than selling bell bottoms at the Broadway or the Make Company. So I took the job, and I had the time of my life. Worked my tail off, 5 shows in 6 weeks. You rehearse 1 show during the day, perform the other one at night, no nights off. I have the fondest memories of that summer. And it actually marked the beginning of a career as a professional dancer that I said I never wanted, that ended up financing the rest of my college education. I still take dance class every Saturday from Walter some 44 years later with a bunch of old dancers. It's the highlight of my week. But I want you to hear I never set my sights in that direction with any intention at all. Just like I never set my sights with any intention on this career of chaplaincy. So what is it that makes a stranger sometimes more perfect for us than a loved one, a friend, a family member? For one thing, a stranger generally has no agenda for us, no need to fix us or advise us or correct us or contextualize our feelings for us on our behalf. More often than not, they're completely indifferent to us. And yet in our bumping up against one another, sometimes there can be a gift, maybe an awakening, a revelation of a new truth, or a reminder of an old one. Years ago, I had a breast cancer patient named Dorothy, whom I would visit every week in the infusion clinic while she was getting her chemo. Her husband, Frank, came to every appointment. Frank was a bit of a grumpy Gus, kind of a curmudgeonly fellow. He was also a passionate collector and restorer of classic cars. I listened to many stories about their cross-country trips to various car shows. One week, Frank was telling me what happened when they left the clinic the previous week. That week, he had chosen to drive one of his restored beauties to the appointment. And when they went back out to the parking structure after her chemo was finished, he found the side of his car bashed in. Now, for those of you who have been in that spot, I have more times than I care to count. You know that feeling of outrage. And he walked closer to the car, and then he saw the note under the windshield wiper: name, address, insurance information, apology, promise to make good on the damage. I had just been listening to Frank for weeks talk about how disenchanted he had become with the human race, and here he was given this gift. Michael, I gotta tell you, it was almost worth the hassle of having to get my car repaired just to be reminded that there's still good people out there in the world. Sometimes, you know, Frank, it was his creative choice to find the meaning in that ordeal, but it was the stranger, having done the right thing, that provided the catalyst. Sometimes a stranger can be a kind of teacher. In the late fall of 2009, my husband Scott and I took a trip to Eastern Europe, and we made a stop in Krakow, Poland, in order to visit Auschwitz, Birkenau. For those of you who haven't been, as you might imagine, it's an overwhelming, devastating experience. We chose to rent a couple of those Acoustic guides to tour the camps at our own pace rather than join a guided tour group, thinking that might dilute our experience. It was hard to know what to do with the sheer volume and intensity of feeling that would come up with each step, rounding each corner. There were so many moments I wanted to say, stop, get me out of here, I cannot breathe. And yet you knew you had to. You had to bear witness to every inch that you could. It would somehow be a sin not to. In the years since, there have been those who have asked me, Jews among them, why would you ever have wanted to go, particularly as a Gentile? I mean, I get it, it's a place of pilgrimage for Jews, but why was it important for you to go? It always struck me as an odd question. The best answer I have is that it's important to me to try to bear witness to the absolute worst of humanity, as much as I would want to bear witness to the best of humanity. Not only to bear witness to it, but to try to own that those aspects of humanity are alive and well within me too. Anger, hatred, cruelty, indifference, apathy. I try to embrace the notion that nothing human is foreign to me. Nothing human is foreign to me. It always seemed a little glib to dismiss the Holocaust as some kind of aberration committed by subhuman evil monsters. Thank God I'm not like that, huh? It was unseasonably cold for late October, bitterly cold, in fact. As I was walking the camps, I found myself wondering about the more peripheral workers at the camps, who most certainly had to have witnessed the most horrific scenes day in and day out, and presumably went home to families and loved ones, normal life. How was that possible? Hi, hon, I'm home. How was your day? Is it really humanly possible to compartmentalize to that degree? And just then, this sweet little stray cat rubbed against my ankle. And he was weaving his way in and around my feet, purring his head off, and I squatted down to give him some love. Come here, sugar. And I'm trying to squeeze myself into this tiny bubble of sweetness and love, desperately wanting a reprieve from all of this horror. And in an instant, feeling so guilty for wanting that reprieve and taking it, and in the same instant, realizing I had my answer. That's how it's done. You simply move into a different bubble of reality. That cat was my teacher. That cat was a perfect stranger. A colleague of mine, a social worker, asked me to go see Bruce in the hospital, who was dying of liver cancer. I only met Bruce the one time, and I only saw him through this narrow window of critical illness at the end of his life. Still, such a narrow opening can offer a surprisingly intimate view, particularly to the stranger. Bruce is one who had lived his life on a very big stage, lots of power, a world of corporate boardrooms and international travel. His world had now shrunk down to the size of his hospital room. Not having many friends or family about locally, his society had been distilled down to the doctors and nurses and housekeeping staff who came in to clean his room. Bruce seemed to be at a kind of spiritual crossroads. He wanted to connect with the Methodist faith he remembered from his distant youth, not knowing how. He wanted to pray, but not knowing how or for what. It all seemed kind of hopeless and empty now. So rather than launch into some lofty theological discussion, I invited Bruce to start closer in, narrowing our focus on the magic inherent in tiny gestures of kindness, tender mercies, if you will. Oh, I understand exactly what you mean, Michael. Last night, I had the most wonderful conversation with the woman who came in to clean my room. Now, if you'd met Bruce, you'd never peg him as the one to start a conversation with the housekeeping staff. But life had changed. The world had changed. She was it in that moment. Michael, she had the sweetest smile, and she was so kind, and she was so warm. She just made me feel like it was all going to be okay. She even gave me a little gift. His eyes filled with tears as he proudly pointed to the little plastic angel sitting on the bookshelf in his room. I knew he had been touched by the healing power of just being seen, of kindness, of connection. I, for one, put my faith in that kind of connection, that kind of connectedness between strangers. A few years ago, I was invited to speak at the cancer support community out in Calabasas in Westlake to an audience of primarily cancer patients. And afterwards, there was a time for Q&A. And a woman asked me what I thought was the meaning of life. Oh, that. Well, while I was trying to come up with some kind of answer, she didn't wait for my answer. She wanted to tell me hers. And she said, well, I believe, Michael, that the meaning of life is that everybody wants to be known, as in seen, received, understood. I remember at the time my judging mind going into overdrive. Well, that's way too simplistic, and thank you for sharing, dear. Next question. But I have quoted her countless times in the years since, because I think she came close to hitting the nail right on the head. I've experienced it too many times myself. I've witnessed it too many times in others. The healing power in just being seen, in being received, in being accepted in life at this moment as it is. A year ago, I went to fill up my car at the local gas station, the USA station with the lowest prices in the neighborhood. This particular afternoon, it was jumping. There was no pump available, so I waited my turn, and I pulled in. I filled up my car, and then I'm carefully backing away from the pump, and I'm checking my side view mirror. I'm checking my rear view mirror. I'm checking my camera, and then I hear crunch. I had hit one of those 3-foot-tall concrete posts that was there to protect the apparently very fragile concrete curb that was there surrounding the gas station sign. It was the one spot completely out of view of my mirrors and my camera. I didn't know it in that moment, but it was a $1,500 mistake. Now, anybody who knows me knows that such a mistake is proof in my mind that I don't deserve to live. I wish I were kidding. I got out of the car to inspect the damage, and I'd hit it in just the right way that the bumper, the hatch cover, the rear quarter panel, and the taillight were all damaged. The taillight lay there on the concrete like some wounded animal. As I stood there staring in shock, contemplating my own suicide, I didn't notice the man in front of me who was pumping gas in his car who had seen the whole thing. Big strapping fellow whom you would never cast to be the merciful angel in this moment. He walks over to me and just says, oh, man, that's rough. I'm sorry, dude. said with all the compassion he could muster, and not knowing what else to do, he bends over and picks up my taillight, and he tenderly hands it to me as if it is a wounded animal. And I take the taillight and I put it in the trash. And there's a part of me that's observing the whole scene and sees how preposterous it is and even sees the black humor in it, but I'm way too caught up in my own grief, but also in gratitude. I knew in that moment he really softened the blow for me by seeing it, being my witness. He got it, what it felt like. I couldn't thank him enough for his kindness. In our 39 years together, Scott and I have always had cats. In December of 01, our boy Junior died. There has never been one before or since quite like Junior Junebug. It was a Friday morning, and Junior died at home. Scott was en route coming home from a business trip to New York. So I stayed home from work and stayed with Junior's body, thinking that Scott might want to see him to say goodbye before we took him in to get cremated. So Scott's plane finally lands, and he calls me from the cab, and I told him Junior's gone. And I said, do you want to see him or do you want me to take him in to the vet? And he said, I can't see him like that. Would you please do that? So I drove him over to the vet, and I didn't want to bring his little body in through the lobby where everybody's picking up their dogs and cats. So I left him in the car and I went up to the front desk and I just choked it out. My boy's dead. Would somebody please come out to the car and get him for me? So I go back out to the car and I'm holding Junior for the last time. And out comes this little Latino vet's assistant. And when he sees me, his shoulders just do that. He just stops in his tracks. And he just saw me. And I kissed Junior for the last time. And I handed him over. And I got back in the car. And I just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. There was a couple picking up their German Shepherd who had seen the whole thing. They walked over to my car window and knocked. I rolled down the window. And they just said, can we drive you home? I didn't accept their offer, but their speaking those five words changed my life. It imprinted my heart with a new benchmark of what it means to be kind, what it means to be seen. What is it that keeps us from being the perfect stranger, from being the one who's willing to step up and say, I'll be your witness? I'll see you. I'll face my own vulnerability and knowing there's nothing I can do to make it better. I do think that's it right there. It is not easy to come close to another suffering knowing there is nothing you can say or do. Nothing but be there. Nothing but offer kindness. Be a witness. Last summer, I was speaking at another congregation, and a man came up to me and asked, how is it possible for you to create such meaningful relationships with your patients when they're total strangers? It must take a lot of time to build that kind of trust, huh? And I thought about it for a moment. I thought, you know what? Generally, no, it doesn't. It takes no time at all. The stakes are too high. Hearts are already broken wide open. It just doesn't make sense to stand on formalities and ceremony. Much in the same way, one might have a very meaningful, even intimate conversation with a total stranger one meets while traveling, particularly to a very faraway place. There you both are, foreign territory, completely out of your element, vulnerable. It just doesn't make any sense to stand behind the facades we stand behind when we're at home. Not long ago, a friend of mine lost his elderly mother, and I called him the day after she died to just check in and say, how you doing? And he said, the crazy thing is, my partner keeps waiting for me to cry and fall apart, and I guess I do too, but of course I just don't. But I'm finding strangers get past my defenses in a way that those closest to me just can't. A few years back, I had a patient, Randy, who was in his 50s, colon cancer, stage 4. I had so many wonderful conversations with him over the last 2 years of his life. Not long before he died, I was walking him out of the clinic and we're standing out in the hallway chatting, and up walks another patient on a walker, gingerly making her way to the front door of the clinic. He says, excuse me, Michael, and he goes over and he just holds the door for her. There you go, sweetheart. And he comes back to me and says, you see, Michael, the way I see it, that's my job now, to be kind. Randy's life was one that was animated by professional success. He was a high-power commercial real estate guy. His professional life had now been distilled down to the value of kindness. Life had taken so much from him, but it hadn't taken that. Hadn't taken away the ability to be kind. Hadn't taken away that ability to still find meaning in what was left of his life. Many years ago, I saw an interview on TV between Bill Moyers and Pema Chodron, the well-known Buddhist author and teacher. They were talking about New York after 9/11, and Bill was commenting on how New Yorkers behaved after 9/11, not like New Yorkers at all, but they were really watching out for each other, checking in, showing kindness to one another. Pema said, but then Bill said, after things got back to normal, they started behaving like New Yorkers again. Pema said, that's because after 9/11, New Yorkers really understood the groundless nature of life, that there is nothing to hold on to. And when you really get it, that life is groundless, the only response that makes any sense at all is kindness to ourselves and each other. It's so deceptively simple. It's such a wildly undervalued virtue. And yet, I believe it is the path to being the perfect stranger. And in the recognition and gratitude for the kindness shown to us, we get to experience the magic of so many perfect strangers in our midst, particularly those who just might be willing to drive us all the way home. So be it.